Check one, two, check one. Okay, that's good. And where's the stupid, the other thing here?
Recording in progress.
All right. Good morning and welcome to the Poetry Show, which we are broadcasting weekly at 10 o'clock on www.enlightenradio.org. And in case you are on one of those very teeny devices, like your phone, it's possible that the actual player, which sits at the top of the page on enlightenradio.org, it might not show up on your phone. So if that happens, you can go to player.enlightenradio.org. And we're on pretty much 24 hours a day, not entirely, but Wednesdays, 10 o'clock is the Poetry Show. And I'd like to introduce my wonderful host and my inspiration for returning to poetry after I, you know, left it in 1970 for labor agitation. Anyway, so, and I'm just delighted that we have a real live poet on with us this morning, which I'm going to let Janet introduce and start the show. Janet.
I'm trying to find the introduction, John, if you'll just talk for a moment.
Oh, well, I can talk all day. But
It's missing in my email.
Yes, one of my main memories of my mother is actually that, John, would you just shut up? You're giving me a splitting headache. So she didn't give up on me entirely. So anyway, also a little bit more on the schedule this week. We have Recovery Radio tomorrow at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And we're going to be undertaking a new project with Recovery Radio, which is to produce testimonies related to mental illness and the stigma that either socially or in employment or other places or within families sometimes results, and the obstacles that people have to overcome. I mean, there's a lot of long history to this issue, but nonetheless, these testimonies are kind of interesting, and there's people in Shepherdstown that are ready to help produce them. So we'll see how that project goes. And then on Friday, we have the our Winners and Losers radio program, and Karen Valentine is back in town in Shepherdstown, and that's always an event. We spent some time out with the UAW picket lines twice in the past month, and that was quite an event and an interview we had. So anyway, are you ready, Janet, to get started?
Yes, I am. It took me a while. Sorry.
All right. Well, no problem. All right. Take care.
Deborah Garish, my dear friend, is the author of four collections of poems, Indeed Jasmine 2022, which we'll be reading from today, Light and Light 2017, The Language of Paisley 2012, and the chapbook The Language of Rain 2008. Her poems have appeared in Arapet, Lips, the Journal of New Jersey Poets, the Stillwater Review, Worksheets, The Practicing Poet, A Constellation of Kisses, The Strategic Poet, The Patterson Literary Review, Royal Beauty, and any other anthologies. Her poem, Tulipet Palm, is featured in Morning Winds 2023, and her poems, The Wounded Angel and The Soul Speaks Out, were both finalists in Tiferet Poetry Contest. She has been interviewed on radio stations in Colorado and Florida, and now in West Virginia, and has been featured on YouTube. She's received a doctorate in education and literary education from Rutgers University, where she was awarded an Edward Fry Fellowship for scholarship research on poetry process, and holds an MFA in poetry from Drew University. As an educator, she taught English for over 38 years in the New Jersey public schools and served as vice president of programs 2012 to 2015 and board of trustees 2015 to 2016 for Women Who Write Incorporated. She teaches poetry workshops at Farleigh Dickinson University, gives reading, participates in writing conference. She lives in Murray Hill, New Jersey with her husband, Jim, and her cat, Isaac. Oh, did I do that okay, Deborah?
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you.
We're delighted that she was able to join us live for this interview. And we're going to start out with a poem that she calls an Ars Poetica. And an Ars Poetica is a poem about the process of writing poetry. And Deborah, this is a short poem, so I want you to read it, pause, and then read it again, because it's worth hearing twice.
Okay, sure. All right, the poem is entitled Alakazam. Alakazam, out of the boneyard, out of dusty ruins, out of what Yeats calls a mouthful of air, you wrestle as I am doing now, like Jacob with the angel. Poems may be born twice, first in the imagination, then in a calligraphy of sound, once in the head, then twice from the heart. And the child poem, that new birth, uproots whatever you thought possible. Okay, I'll read it again. Alakazam, out of the boneyard, out of dusty ruins, out of what Yeats calls a mouthful of air. You wrestle as I am doing now, like Jacob with the angel. Poems may be born twice, first in the imagination, then in a calligraphy of sound, once in the head, then twice from the heart. And the child poem, that new birth, uproots whatever you thought possible.
I'm very fond of this poem, and I've never seen anyone talk about poems being born twice, so I think this is very original. I don't know where that came from for you, but it was, you know, the imagination and the calligraphy of sound, the head and then the heart. It was just very original and very striking.
You know, the calligraphy is a written form of language, right? That is actually not based on the sound of words, right? Like phonetic languages or et cetera, you know, where you, that's what caught me about the phrase, the calligraphy of sound, because, you know, it's a very, very interesting, usually they're apart from each other, but in a poem, mm-hmm. maybe together.
Yes.
Well, the born again quality of the poem, is as it gets revised and it gets extended. Okay, so by crafting it, you are elaborating, and then by revising, you're extending it. It's a layering of ideas and phrases that are swirling in my head, whatever, maybe during the week or on that day or when I sit down to write, and it just pours out. And then you have to, of course, craft it and hone it. Also, there's a play with sounds such as alakazam, calligraphy, child poem. There's a building of sounds. But the first inspiration for this poem was Yeats's quote when he calls his poetry or a poem a mouthful of air. And I found that kind of very mesmerizing because that's exactly what we do in the creative process. We take a mouthful of air in poetry writing, and we turn it into a narrative, a lyric poem, a short epic poem, a ghazal, a limerick, a haiku. And so out of that mouthful of air, lo and behold, there is creativity. And poema actually comes from I think it's the Greek, that means a made thing or a homemade thing. So we take nothingness and we turn it into somethingness. So that's basically, you know, what this poem did. I loved the word alakazam. This poem was inside a larger poem. And I kept revising it. And oftentimes I'll look to see, well, where is the best writing? And then I'll extract that. And this is the poem that was extracted from the larger poem. So kind of like a poem within a poem that was elaborated, and then all the excess words are shaken off or shook off. And then this is what's distilled.
And it is distilled. It's a very powerful, very, very moving poem. And I go back to it and think about that, how a poem happens to come to me. And they come in different ways. Right. Different poems have different paths into the page. But this one I really enjoyed.
Thank you.
I was tucked from the beginning, from out of the boneyard, out of the dusty ruins, out of what Yeats calls a mouthful of air. That introduction was very powerful, too, as well as some of the other points we've already made about the poem. So this next poem is, I'll just let Deborah introduce it. It's called At the Tenement Museum, and it is a very powerful, very moving poem.
Okay, so shall I read it first?
You can read it first, yes.
Okay, At the Tenement Museum. And I'll just give a little introduction, a short introduction. I took a tour of the Tenement Museum in New York City on Orchard Street. And there are two historical tenement buildings where immigrants resided from 1863 to 1935. They were Germans, Russians, Jewish people, Irish, Europeans, and they all came to the Lower East Side from other countries in order to find job opportunities in the garment industry. And there's kind of an overlay with my family history in this poem. I am of Armenian and a descent, and my grandparents' family came here just avoiding the main thrust of the Armenian genocide in 1915. Back in 1895, the Sultan massacred 80,000 to 300,000 Armenians and Assyrians, leaving 50,000 orphans. And my great-grandparents left and came through Ellis Island at that point in time in order to avoid the first phase of the massacre of the Armenian genocide. And I bring my father into it, who his family had settled on 9th Avenue in New York City. So that was the connection. At the Tenement Museum, I'm thinking of my father, families boxed in chicken coops, blurred into one building, late 19th century tenants, turn of the century dreams, winding flights of staircase, their only outhouse at the city curb. Narrow shotgun apartments, no windows. The Irish couple's American-born infant screams in a tin bucket cradle beside them. A line strung above basin, scrub board, and stove. Laundry limp over two sisters' bed. The living room, a dorm by night, a workshop by day. Four sons sleep on the couch, feet elevated on crates. At daybreak, the family bends to their work, cutting, designing, fitting, and sewing dress patterns for Sears on their good housekeeping sewing machine. A better life than in Ireland or the farm. In summer, heaps of horse manure steam in the streets. In winter, a dead horse. They carved him up once he thawed. This afternoon, I empty the ashtray. I scan the city from the window of the Algonquin. I'm thinking of my father as a young boy living on 9th Avenue in 1918, his father dying of the Spanish flu, a family of 10 stuffed into a one-room apartment, his mother's sister, Susie, a teenager in a thin dress, her infected leg. They wrapped it in newspaper and garlic. She died from gangrene.
That is a very, very powerful poem.
Wow. What a narrative.
Thank you. So when I toured the Tenement Museum, they told us that they all had to run down like five flights of stairs to get to the outhouse outside to make it in time.
Wow.
And then I read that in 1901, they might have had one or two toilets, you know, dispersed on the different floors. So, you know, when they came from the other country, in quotes, of course, they didn't have any medical knowledge or anything like that. And they did what their parents had done to take care of them. So because of lack of antibiotics or medicine or medical knowledge, this was, you know, how they dealt with their traumas. So that was one example.
Wow. So these are your grandparents? Your parents?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. How long did they work in the garment industry for the most of the time they were here?
Well, they didn't. They lived on 9th Avenue, and this was a parallel with what was going on down in the Lower East, you know, where the Tenement Museum is. So I drew a parallel, but they were more like itinerants. They followed wherever there were silk mills, and they actually worked in the silk mills.
Interesting.
Yeah. So there was a connection with, mm-hmm. you know, the textile industry. And
well, it's a very intense account. And, you know, but it reads, it doesn't read at first like a poem. It reads like a very well-prepared speech in a certain way. But then about halfway through it, I felt it was a poem. You know, I felt it taking me over in the way that a poem can take you over with, you know, more than the literal story. There was just the emotion that was channeling through it, and the feeling was, Janet's right, it's very powerful. And was that an all-at-once thing, or did you also go through substantial editing or honing on that one?
As I recall, it was, well, after taking the tour, all of these ideas were kind of swimming in my head. And while I was in the tour, I kept thinking of, you know, of my family. So, you know, they say 95% of the writing is done in your head beforehand. Then you sit down to paper, and then, yeah, and then that's when, you know, the crafting takes over, and yeah, lots of revisions. Yeah. But we have the convenience of a computer these days, not like
so
the old Remington typewriters. So we don't have to white out and use carbon copy. We can cut and paste. So, you know, what you think might only be 5 revisions could be like 25 revisions, because it's like intuitive as we're doing it, you know?
Sure.
Yes. Yeah, so this is just, this captures a lot about the immigrant experience. I thought that was just a very, very, very powerful poem.
Yeah, what really struck me was when I heard that a dead horse in the street, they would have to wait. It would stay in the street until it could thaw out and they could lift it and dispose of it. It's kind of...
In wintertime, yeah.
Incredible.
You mean they didn't just carve it up for food? Right?
It was frozen.
Yeah, right.
In the winter.
Well, did your family, you must have heard stories of all those experiences, right? Right.
Yes,
so,
great.
So visiting
great
the museum.
Story.
Wow, wow. Yeah. Do you like that kind of, with that kind of poem, I mean, you could extend the concept of a narrative poem back to what it once was. You know, it's kind of, it's a gift, you know, to tell a story in such a story-bound way that your poem could last as long as Homer's, but before someone bothered to write it down.
Yeah. We have to do just write these family stories down, and the family secrets and all of that. That's a whole other
volumes.
You
can't see this poem, John, because you didn't. I didn't get the photocopies to you in time, but it's done in three-line stanzas, and it's very, very tightly controlled. The end words are all very carefully chosen. You know, the line right. breaks are very carefully chosen. Okay. It's very carefully crafted.
Thank you.
And that ending with the ant and the gangrene is just a poem can end many different ways. It can end, you know, quietly. You know, it can just come to a really hush. It can end with a click, or it can end with like an explosion. And this poem ends with an explosion.
Yeah. It's like, whoa, you know, it's like you're going down the street and you have to stop your car because there's a body in the middle of the road.
Right. Yeah.
So it was very, very, very strong poem. And I don't know, I'm not as familiar with people who write about the immigrant experience in poetry. I know some people have, but it's done more frequently in prose. There's a lot of novels from this era, but I don't know of many poems.
Well,
it could just be my absence.
Can you all see this, you know, my image that I use when I'm not, you know, visible on video is actually a sculpture entitled The Immigrant. If I can, hold on a second. You can see it there. It's by an Italian sculptor. And I always thought that was, you know, a fabulous, you know, you see the immigrant, but you don't see hardly any of him. I mean, so much is missing, right, that he's brought with him. And I thought that was just a pretty stunning image.
What's the title of that?
It's called The Immigrant. And, you know, but when I get off here and I can get out of this screen, I'll send you guys the link I have to the – it's an Italian sculptor. Yeah, I'll send it to you, but yeah. I'll make sure I get
amazing.
It out to you. Anyway.
So that was, I'm almost catching my breath after that poem, Deborah.
Thank you.
And I've read it before, but just hearing it in your voice was amazing.
Thank
and
you.
The next poem is just is a different leap. It's called My Great Mistake. And I love this title. I love Deborah's title. But who wouldn't want to read a poem called My Great Mistake? You know, it's just so inviting. You have to figure out, you know, what was her great mistake? You know, what is she going to tell us?
Okay, so, all right, this poem is a tribute to my mother. My great mistake is to not continue my mother's creative project. Her wallpapered rooms with shooting stars, hallways covered with burnished glass reflecting light, and the hi-fi blasting Mozart throughout the house like haunting laughter from sisters in the backyard. Such a mistake not to continue my mother's creative design. The French portrait of roses above the fireplace, the vase of gardenias on the mahogany Steinway, her paints and sable brushes, her tonic of color rising from the cellar. I often dream what it would be like to tie pink ribbons around my ankles and dance across the blue earth into eternity, and dance the blue earth into eternity.
Why don't you read this again, Deborah, a little bit slower?
Okay. My great mistake is to not continue my mother's creative project. Her wallpapered rooms crowded with shooting stars, hallways covered with burnished glass reflecting light, and the hi-fi blasting Mozart throughout the house like haunting laughter from sisters in the backyard. Such a mistake not to continue my mother's creative design. The French portrait of roses above the fireplace, the vase of gardenias on the mahogany Steinway, her paints and sable brushes, her tonic of color rising from the cellar. I often dream what it would be like to tie pink ribbons around my ankles and dance across the blue earth into eternity. And dance the blue earth into eternity.
There's some lovely description in this poem, a hallway crowded with shooting stars, hallways covered with burnished glass reflecting light, wallpaper rooms covered with shooting stars. That just really caught me from the beginning, the idea of having glass reflecting in the hallway and all of these things. But the turn at the end, when you go through, you know, her tonica color rising from the cellar, and then you go, there's this turn where you go to, I often dream what it'd be like to tie pink ribbons around my ankles and dance across the blue earth into eternity. And dance the blue earth into eternity. I wonder where that turn came from.
Well, you know, that's a good question. When we're writing something, we don't always know how it comes about until we go back and we look at it. And I can surmise that I was involved in dance as a child and as a young teenager. And I can remember putting on the ballet slippers with the pink satin ribbons. And I wanted to get everything from my, you know, childhood, most of my childhood into this that was art related. And I loved dance. And it was the pink satin ribbons that stuck in my head. And, you know, it's about an elevation into another kingdom through the arts. And it's very transformative. So that's kind of what's packed into this is all the wonderful influences that my mother and my father had on their children, and seeking beauty in the pursuit of art and seeking it in nature and everywhere else. So, and then of course the title, My Great Mistake, is an irony because I am obviously pursuing the art. So, there is a twist to it as well.
Yes, you are dancing in a different way these days.
Yes. Yes. Well, and I also love this quote that I'm always quoting forever and ever by Theodore Retke. Art is our defense against hysteria and death. And it is so true. I mean, because of that transformative and freeing effect of art on us, of poetry writing in my case, you know, the emotions get freed up. It's a way, writing is a way of regulating those emotions and stabilizing a destabilized circumstance. So by immersing yourself or myself in the arts, it helps to free us up. And in turn, the poem is a snapshot of that moment in time that will help readers be freed up as well, you know, when they can identify with your emotions. If they see themselves in the mirror of your poem, in the mirror of your snapshot, they too can be freed up.
So I just found a quote from Kafka that I was looking for, but I never read the whole full quote. And this is about books. And he says, we need books that affect us like a disaster, that grieve us deeply, like the death of someone we have loved more than ourselves, like being banished in the forest, far from everyone, like a suicide. And here's the quote I remember. A book must be the axe for the frozen sea inside us.
Oh, that's beautiful. Must be an axe.
And the book must be a what? An axe?
An axe.
Oh, an axe.
Yes,
okay.
For the frozen sea inside us.
As is prose.
I've never
so
read the Ruskin quote. That's what came to mind. It just floated it up. The book must be an axe for the frozen sea inside us. And it breaks us open. I think your tenement poem was one of those poems that breaks us open. And this does in another very gently way. It's more like a flower opening, whereas the tenement poem was like a hammer, you know, blows 1, 2, 3, 4. This is very gentle. It's a different mood for your poetry.
Hmm. I like what you said about that. I never thought of it that way. Thank you.
Well, that's why you have readers.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Maybe the poem is a mirror. Maybe it's through a glass darkly.
Yes.
The other side, right. That blue to eternity, right?
And I was going to have Deborah read one more poem. This one you'll like, John, and you're with given that your wife is from New Jersey.
Yes,
and
she's
I'll
a,
have her.
Right. I should have mentioned that in the beginning when you introduced Deborah, that Carol's a very Jersey. She was raised in New Brunswick or near New Brunswick. Her dad taught physics at Rutgers, where you graduated
wow.
from. Yeah.
It's remarkable.
Yeah, he was
okay, so,
interesting. But,
oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's all.
He was, I'm sorry.
She had all her sisters and everybody. They were raised there in Jersey, and she has an almost, I would call it a Jersey ideology. I think there is one. So, anyway.
And she has kept up with some friends from Jersey for years and years and years. There's a little group of women that are still in touch with each other that grew up
wow.
together.
Oh boy, that's great.
Yeah. No, they're high school. They were all high school together, and they're still together. 50 years later, 60 almost now. 50.
Wow. 50. Don't say 60. Carol will hit you.
No, she won't. Right. She's younger than me. That's true. So.
Okay. So introduce your poem, Deborah.
All right. Dreaming the Garden State. I imagine the landscape of Eagle Rock Reservation overlooking the Hudson, New York City, the other side of the river, Route 9 connecting ocean towns from Avon to Cape May, long before the secret got out. The crested cardinal with its slurred whistles, New Jersey, wild canary, blue meadow, violets, cranberry fields, blueberries, tomatoes, eggplant like the darkest wine in Albertine wineskins. I call out Princeton, Paramus Blue Laws, Monmouth Thoroughbreds moving like the wind. Rutherford, Patterson, Magnolia, and peonies, hymns that run through my veins. Nana's summer tapestry of meals, children should be seen and not heard. I trace the wooden cyclone roller coaster of the Palisades, Votee Park's ice pond, flashes of skates, bonfires, that first time feeling of driving my secondhand Chevy. Murray the K's swinging soiree blasting on the radio. I envision Atlantic City, conch shells, one-legged sandpipers, Lucy the Elephant Hotel, the salty air of Boardwalk. Even as the world circles, I recall Jersey, my mother of pearl.
Yeah, very good. I like that. I'm gonna have to get a copy of the book here from Janet and show that to Carol. She'll love that.
So this is just a nostalgic poem of everything that symbolizes and represents New Jersey to me. Going back to, Atlantic City and way back in the 1920s, there's this Lucy, the Elephant Hotel. The elephant is still there. It's no longer a hotel. And, just the Jersey Shore and Monmouth Thoroughbreds and the cyclone at the Palisades, which, of course, is no longer there. There's all condominiums. And then my secondhand Chevy. Driving that for the very
Absolutely.
First time, the thrill of being alone in the car for the first time and having this independence and these wings. And it's just, a little timeline of my existence in New Jersey.
The way you did a wonderful job, and you did it without quoting Springsteen or. Yeah, I thought that was great. So,
yeah.
I don't want to diss Bruce, but. Because he's pretty emblematic too, so anyway, that was very nice. Very nice.
Thanks.
Do you go back to Jersey much? I mean, you have.
He lives there now.
Oh, you live.
I haven't left.
Oh, you haven't left. Oh, okay. Well, I know.
I haven't left.
actually, when Carol left, she first place went was to New England, and I think before she had moved back to Jersey, she'd go to New England first, you know, but she really loves Vermont and New Hampshire. So.
Oh, nice.
Anyway, very nice.
Thank you.
Anyhow, I thought it was a very moving poem and very it's a blend. It's almost a list poem, but there's a little bit of narrative, you know, tucked in with it too. So I think it's very very effective the way you did that.
Thank you.
I grew up in Pennsylvania. Of course, Pennsylvanians all look down on New Jersey, so this is remedial.
That's funny. Didn't, whatever state you're from, they always look down on other states. I don't know why. It's just, I don't know.
Well, now, William Carlos Williams, right? I mean, he made an entire universe out of Patterson, sort of.
He did.
So there's been other, you know, notable Jersey poets. I thought the Dodge Poetry Festival, which we attended many times, right, in
yes,
Newark. Well, also up toward the Highlands before they moved it down to Newark. But there were quite a few poets, a poetry culture in Jersey that, you know, Amir Baraka, remember when he showed up there and... did a beautiful That's job, right. actually. So, so I salute New Jersey poetry. Wonderful.
So it's a little tribute. We'll go out on Jersey as Mother of Pearl.
All right. Yeah. So are we done for the day? Is that the...
Yes, we're done for the day, John.
Okay. Well, Deborah, thank you so much. Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much. Okay. It's been delightful. Oh, well, everybody, thank you for tuning into the Poetry Show. If you want, we'll turn this into a podcast before the day's done. And it will be on podcasts.enlightenradio.org. Okay, so you can see it there. Anyway, thank you guys so much. Take care of each other. It's late, but everything comes next.
Thank you.